Okay, so far we've heard from Guy and Adam all the basics about what is commonly used in tomography, in seismic tomography, all the basic tools and the basic assumptions, theoretical assumptions that are used for seismic tomography. And what I'm going to talk about is, you know, where do we go next? What is it that we need? Why do we need some improvements? What are the current challenges in tomography? So far, what we've looked at is, on the one hand side, we've looked at body waves, and body waves have been described using ray theory, very simply, essentially just tracing rays through the mantle and assuming that the ray isn't perturbed by lateral heterogeneity, so that you can compute the travel time anomaly by summing the travel time anomaly accumulated at each point along the ray due to some velocity heterogeneity. On the other hand, we've also seen that for surface waves, a similar simplifying assumption has been made, which is commonly referred to as the path average approximation. Basically, surface waves have energy concentrated along the surface, and in to first order, you can basically assume that what they see is the average structure in a vertical slice containing the source and the receiver, and average horizontally. So they see a 1D structure as expressed here. Clearly, this approximation does not work for body waves, for which you would want to have to see the ray character come out. Both approximations are really infinite frequency approximations, and so if we want to be more accurate, we need to try and see how we can incorporate more of the more realistic assumptions about how different types of waves depend on or sense the structure. Now, the body wave, the travel time tomography, actually, the infinite frequency approximation works pretty well, especially for P waves. And in fact, I'd like to point out, I'm going to talk about improved theories, but I would like to point out that the main problem we have with the travel time tomography is that the coverage is actually limited. And I think Guy already showed one version of the same figure showing the density of rays for the type of travel time data that you can get from the ISC catalogs at two depths in the mantle, here near the 660 kilometer discontinuity and here at the bottom of the mantle. And as you can see, there is good coverage around the subduction zones and some continental areas, just because that's where the earthquakes happen, and also there's most of the stations. But the oceanic areas are fairly devoid of sampling, and as you go deeper into the mantle and reach the core mantle boundary region, this does not really improve, and you have the additional problem that in order to really sample this region, you need to use diffracted waves, and ray theory does not work for diffracted waves. However, these P models, of course, are, and this approach of travel time tomography is very well suited to look at areas such as subduction zones and get some high resolution images of these regions. I would like to, although I'm going to be talking about theory, I want to make a point here that this coverage issue is really a very big issue. And the Princeton group recently has been, I think, misleading the community in that they are coming out with this model of plumes in the mantle. And that's fine. Maybe these plumes exist, maybe they don't. But they've been claiming that the reason why they see them is because they have an improved theory. Well, they're still using P type waves, travel times. And in fact, I believe that their models are still problematic because of the coverage problem. Here, this is from a recent geophysical journal paper by Montelli et al. Showing the comparison between their model based on ray theory and on finite and more advanced so-called finite frequency approximation. And in fact, they look very, very similar. The only differences between these models are in some of the intensity of some of those low velocity zones that they have associated with plumes. But there are many, there are other ways you could get amplitude differences between these two types of inversions, and in particular, just from the necessity of including damping and the damping working differently in both cases, just because you have a different, slightly different set of equations. So I want to, yes?
Is there a superplume in this picture?
Well, no.
Okay.
There isn't, but there's lots of little plumes.
At the top picture, now you can see the red in the atmosphere and the red in the Pacific.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So you, I mean, I guess you could say, that. No, this is. This is the bottom of the mantle, the top one. Yes, it's going the reverse way. Yes, so you, yeah, I guess the low velocity zones under Africa and under the Pacific might be, you know, sort of, if you smear them out, you would see the superplumes. On the other hand, we've also seen that in order to, so the high frequency travel time tomography models give you some high resolution in some limited areas of the world, but they don't really give you the low degree, the very smooth parts of the structure. In order to look at that, you need to include surface waves, which have better sampling across the oceans, and also perhaps mode data, as Guy has been telling us. And when you do this, then you get models, and here is a comparison of four models, recent models, which are based on a combination of surface wave mode and body wave travel time data, or body waveforms in different combinations by different groups, showing some general agreement on the low, long wavelength structure in the mantle. And here you see the superplumes at the bottom. Yeah, okay, I'll show you something. Well, yes, and it also goes the other way around. However, I just want to point out that in the regions of the superplumes, in the regions of the low velocity zones at the bottom of the mantle, that's where the sampling for the travel times is the poorest in general, the P model travel times. And you really need these other types of data to start constraining the upwelling parts of the flow, or of the structure. Sorry, I jumped to conclusions. However, there is some correspondence between these two types of models, and this this shows a comparison between a P model. This is a regional model in around Japan, Japanese model, and at depths here between 400 and 900 kilometers, compared to one sort of low, long wavelength model, which for the same region. And you can see that, in fact, this model is, if you were to filter down the short wavelength model, you would see something very compatible with the long wavelength model. So there is, it's not like these models are incompatible, it's that they, you know, they serve, the different types of data serve different purposes, have in terms of what we can learn about the structure. Now, coming back to travel times, the even if you go to longer period travel times of S-type waves, you do have a sampling problem. And the sampling problem comes from the fact that in order to measure travel times, the phases that you look at have to be isolated on a seismogram from other phases. And there's only a limited number of phases. This is an example of the kind of phases you would use for an S travel time inversion. The limited number, whereas there's much more information, in fact, in a seismogram. You do have the main phases like P and S, SS. You have the fundamental mode surface waves. But there's all sorts of other higher modes and multiply reflected waves that are in there and that you would like to be able to use the information from. In fact, this is travel time curve showing lots of identified phases, seismic phases. And you can see that there's many of them arrive simultaneously and therefore are difficult to really study in detail using just travel time analysis. In fact, what we really want to be doing is full waveform inversion. That is, take a seismogram and use all of the information that is in it. So, for example, here we have, this is a relatively long period filtered waveform. I guess it's a corner frequency of about 30 seconds, showing some phases that would be difficult to analyze just using travel times, maybe not the SS, but here is an S diffracted phase, which you run into problem with ray theory. Then, for example, in this window here, you have two phases arriving at the same time, SSS and SCS2. One samples the top of the mantle, the other samples the whole mantle. It's a multiply reflected phase on the core mantle boundary. These are complementary pieces of information, and because our coverage is not perfect and isn't going to be perfect in any near future, unless we install very dense networks of stations in the oceans, we will have this problem of trying to extract, complementing our coverage by using waveforms of phases that arrive at the same time. So in order to see what the next step is, I just wanted to start with this concept of the Fresnel zone, which helps understand how those sensitivity kernels we obtain when the sensitivity kernels for broadband waveforms is. This concept was introduced by Fresnel in the beginning of the 19th century to explain diffraction phenomena in optics. And basically, the idea was that, to see what the minimum size of an object needs to be before you can really resolve it. Idea is here, it's a reflection geometry. This is a disk that is reflecting light, and this is a transmission geometry, which would be more appropriate for our case. And basically, the idea is that all the waves that are being diffracted by this disk and that are coming from a source to a station in phase will not be distinguishable. And you can work out that this corresponds to a disk of radius r, which is more or less the square root of z lambda over 2, where z is the distance from the source to the center of the diffracting object. And this, if you work it out, basically it means that the different waves coming from the different points of the disk to your station have to be in phase. That the difference between the phase of the direct path and the path coming from another point has to be less than pi, and this corresponds to a distance rho from the point to the source of the scatterer or the station, which is here in a symmetric problem. This distance has to be less than lambda over 2, where lambda is a wavelength, which you can see that the locus of points that would have a constant, will have this constant sum of distances from the source of the station. 2 rho will be constant equal to lambda over 2, will define this Fresnel zone, and that will be an ellipsoid because it's the sum of the distances to two fixed points being constant. So you expect to see these ellipsoids of sensitivity in the kernels. And in fact, I'll just illustrate that straight away. This is an example from a recent preprint, actually, by Yoshida and Kenneth, showing, and I'll go into more details later, but showing at each point in time for a Rayleigh wave waveform in plan view and in cross-section across the middle of the path, how this sensitivity kernel, this is simplified sensitivity kernel in this case, depends on structure, which parts of the structure outside of the Rayleigh path will affect the Rayleigh waves at what time. So it varies with time. It's the sign of the kernel. Positive, probably, yeah. Positive is white, and negative is it's the amplitude, which has a sign, right? Can flip. Well, that's actually it's one view of the banana donuts, which is. Now, but it's for waveforms. The banana donuts, actually, kernels are just for travel with first arrival. And that's why they have this very strange hole in the middle. But if you look at waveforms, the corresponding kernels actually fill out the whole interior. And here is another illustration of how you can see how you build up the waveform by adding up contributions from different portions of the structure around the ray. Here, in this example, this was to kind of see what contributes to the S phase and what contributes to the SS phase, which bounces off the surface once. And the complete, say, the spherical Earth seismogram is U0 at the top. It's the gray seismogram, so showing the S wave, SS, and then the Rayleigh waves. And then what Hank Markarian computed was the contributions from all these different squares here in the middle of the path to basically the sensitivity and how it comes out in the waveform. And you can see that it goes down B1, B2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And you can see as you go down, you first have sensitivity that helps you build the Rayleigh waves and the SS waves. And as you go down, you start building up the S phase. But note that it's not just on the ray, but it's really you're adding information from regions outside of the ray. And this is just showing the comparison between the spherical Earth seismogram and the complete seismogram, and then the one of these contributions, B7, which happens to be the main contribution to the S wave. And if you add the two, you start seeing something that looks very much like the S wave.
Is there an assumption computing?
Yes, there are assumptions. I'll go through this. It's a first order perturbation theory. So the question is, how can we model full waveforms, that is, both body waves, including diffracted waves, and surface waves, both fundamental mode and overtones, in a realistic 3D Earth with relatively accurate kernels? And broadband just meaning we're not looking at infinite frequency, we're looking at seismogram which contains certain band of frequencies. And this additional condition, which is a reasonable computational time for global tomographic inversions. The reason why I mention this is that we're going more and more towards having tools to do the computations numerically quite accurately. Okay, there is sort of most favored approach right now is the spectral element method, which works very well for the type of frequencies that we, in the spherical Earth, that we are interested in for tomography in the mantle. The problem is that right now is that our computers are not quite fast enough to be able to really do a tomographic model with all the iterations in a reasonable time, unless you use the whole Earth simulator in Japan. So probably in the next 10 years, we'll move on to numerical methods, and you know, we'll be able to compute practically exact seismograms and do that very fast. But in the meantime, you know, we still want to make some progress, and in particular, we want to have some understanding. Numerical approaches are really like a black box. So you compute everything, but you don't really know what's happening. And so I think this is there is room for trying to understand things a little better, how things interact with heterogeneity. And so I was going to now spend some time. How does this work?
Okay. Slide that out.
Okay. So I'll try to show just a couple of equations, but sort of tying into what Guy has been showing. One good, one convenient way to do seismograms in the teleseismic field waveforms is the normal mode theory, because as Guy showed you, in the spherical Earth, you can compute a full seismogram just by summation of normal modes, and these are standard method by now. So just to remind you, we start, the easiest computation is, and which will be used as a starting model, is in a spherically non-rotating elastic isotropic model, which is referred to as SNREI. And in that case, you can write the equations of motions introducing a density and elastic model, and they can be written simply by putting all of the complexity of the equation into this elastogravitational differential operator. And then you solve, and then F are the forces, external forces. You first solve for the free oscillations, assuming F equals to zero. You end up with a simple equation. You plug in a form of this type with exponential I omega kt, the frequency omega k. You end up with going into frequency domain with an eigenvalue problem where the mode displacements are the eigenvectors and the frequencies and the eigen with the corresponding eigenfrequencies, and then you get a displacement which for the modes, which as Guy showed you, could be described in terms of spherical harmonics, three integers, an overtone number, an angular order number which describes the spatial variations, and then this M azimuthal order term. Now you can extend this to obtain the case of a general displacement, for example, when you have an excitation by a seismic source, by basically writing the displacement as a sum over normal modes and solving for the coefficients. What we typically would do is one more operation, which is project on a particular component of motion, because we usually have seismograms on the vertical component and then on the two horizontal components. So we like to do this projection, and it turns out that when you plug this into the equations of motions and you take advantage of all the properties of the modes, in particular their orthogonality, you end up with an expression which is a sum over modes of this the temporal dependence here, and an amplitude term which is made up of two components. One is a receiver term. This is the mode calculated at the receiver coordinates, and a source term, which is here already expressed in terms of the moment tensor of the source, and this is the strain tensor, all calculated at the source location. And you can show by working out what these are that this is a very simple expression, which in the case of an isotropic source on the vertical component is even simpler. It involves only this YL0 harmonic, spherical harmonic, and a multiplied by a constant which contains the seismic moment. And because we know that the spherical harmonic can be expressed as, it's basically that's the zeroth order asymptotic approximation away from the nodes, that is away from points where sine of delta is equal to zero, that is the source and its antipode. You can write it essentially as a cosine function depending on L plus 1/2. And so that you get that for a given mode branch, so you fix N and you look at varying as a function of L, the amplitude fluctuations are quasi-periodic. And I just wanted to show you that because it's, I think it's cool. If you look at the spectrum, you can see this very nicely. This is from an old paper by Geneviève Hult and myself, where here we have a spectrum, a vertical component spectrum, at for an earthquake and a station that are about 90 degrees apart. And this spectrum has been filtered here to extract the fundamental modes. And you can see the L here, which is the frequencies of a reference model are given here. And you can pick up one out of two modes, essentially. One mode, and the next one is practically not excited, and again, et cetera. And this is slightly modulated, but this is exactly the fluctuations that you would expect from this dependence of the amplitude term on L. So, okay. Now, in a heterogeneous Earth, of course, there is some complications in the structure. So you still have the same form of the equation of motion, but now you are in a state which is perturbed from the reference spherically symmetric model. And so typically what one will do is use perturbation theory, because the spherical Earth, isotropic, elastic, non-rotating, is an excellent approximation, first-order approximation to the structure of the Earth. Any perturbation due to ellipticity or attenuation or asphericity is really a small perturbation. So you can use perturbation theory, and in fact, what we use most commonly now is first-order perturbation theory, where you write the elastic parameters and the density as the sum of the reference spherically symmetric value plus a perturbation, and same for the elasto-gravitational operator. And you also write the solution as a sum of the reference solution plus a perturbation, and then you work this out. And quite a few pages of algebra, but the result to first order, that is, first order perturbations with respect to a small parameter, you end up with an expression for the seismogram, which now contains additional terms. So the first term, which I now wrote, this was this YL0 delta, which I wrote back, I brought back the receiver and source components of it. I'm skipping a few lines here, but basically this is your amplitude term, and then all of it is multiplied by the time dependence, and then you have two additional terms, one which turns out to be interaction term due to and this should be delta H, really. This should be the perturbation to the elasto-gravitational operator, and this term corresponds to the isolated multiplet case, where you only look at interaction within a given multiplet. So all this is still K, here denotes now a multiplet. The spherical heterogeneity splits the multiplets so that each singlet will have its own frequency, and all the singlets within a multiplet can interact, and then each multiplet can interact with other multiplets. And so you get two terms, one for the interaction within the multiplet, and then another one for which represents coupling between the different multiplets. But all I... Yes? Well, the multiplet is the mode. It's the degenerate mode that you get in a spherical Earth, where you have 2L plus 1, basically modes that have the same frequency, which is what comes out of solving the equations in the spherical Earth case. You get, you need three numbers to describe a mode, the L, the N, and the M. But in the spherical Earth, the mode frequency does not depend on M, and also the depth dependence does not depend on M. The only thing that depends on M is the shape of the mode on the surface. And this is called degeneracy, and it's removed, this degeneracy is removed by asphericity or any departure from spherical Earth. But I guess I don't want to get into more equations, but just the thing to take back home is that you see all these terms have the same form. They have a receiver component, a structure component, and then a source component. So you can think of this as basically looking at the interaction between a wave that goes out of the source, interacts with a heterogeneity at some point, and then comes back to the receiver like this. The sphere in the zero-solder approximations, as we will see, all you collapse everything to the great circle path. If you want to go one step further, you need to take into account these interactions, which in this particular case would be a single scatter, so-called signal scattering interactions with points outside of the great circle. You can complicate this as much as you want and go to multiple scattering, where you would include, this would be single scattering, or the kind of Born approximation that we generally use, where you consider the interaction with only one point at a time, but you can go further and consider interactions with two points or three points, etc., which would be a multiple scattering term. And we won't really consider that. So, so there is these three terms. And basically, you can sort of move up in complexity as you add these terms. And just to illustrate this, if you add the isolated multiplet term, you can see that the form of this term is really, it's producing a frequency shift, because if it's basically, if you take the spherical term and put it outside of parentheses, you get a 1 plus IT times some term here, which is like a frequency shift. And so in the isolated multiplet case, you can write the equations as basically the amplitude of the spherical Earth term times an exponential term in which you will perturb the frequency of the spherical Earth by some quantity lambda k, which is the ratio of this term here to this one. And this term was named the location parameter by Jordan in 1978, and it can be shown that to zeroth order in L, now we're considering this approximation to the spherical functions in terms of these cosine functions, and if you plug that into the equations, you end up with this frequency shift being equal to the great circle average of what's called the local frequency, which we've seen before. Guy has been showing this, and this local frequency, which expresses the integral over depth at a given point on the surface of the Earth of the model perturbations, each of them multiplied by an appropriate kernel. So, for example, if you're looking at a model, elastic model with perturbations in Vs, Vp, and rho, this local frequency calculated at every point on the surface of the Earth would have this form. And the frequency shift that you obtain is just the average over the great circle. And this is kind of a remarkable result, because it means that to this order of approximations, the all you are sensitive to is the average structure along the great circle path which connects the source and the receiver. You're not sensitive to the exact position of the source and the receiver on that great circle. You're not sensitive to the source parameters. And it also has, so you're just sensitive to the average on the great circle path, which also then has an implication, illustrates very well what Guy was telling us about previously, which is that you can only get even order structure out of an isolated multiplet approximation, since the great circle path is symmetric with respect to the center of the Earth. And this is why Guy was able to plot these frequency shifts, which is exactly those location parameter, as a function of, give them a geographical meaning by plotting them at the pole of the great circle path. Okay, since you can associate them in a unique way with the great circle path. And then when he plotted that, he obtained this very striking degree two pattern, which you can then relate back to the heterogeneity. Okay, so the next step is then coupling across different multiplets. So basically what you will need to do is couple, here you would have this, each point would be a multiplet, and then you will introduce terms that couple between different multiplets, and you have a choice of doing it two ways. Or one is along the same dispersion branch, so that you would couple only those multiplets that correspond to a given N, a given mode branch, or couple across branches. So one multiplet here with multiplets in other branches. And if you couple along the branch to zeroth order, you end up adding one more term, which is basically a distance shift. The isolated multiplet gave you a frequency shift. Adding coupling along a branch gives you a distance shift. This distance shift, in fact, is what introduces the asymmetry with respect to the center of the Earth, because it depends, as it can be shown, on the minor arc average of the local frequency, the minor arc average being the average from the source to the receiver, delta here is the epicentral distance, of the local frequency. And obviously this average is not symmetric with respect to the center of the Earth, unless of course the structure is symmetric. But this is how you can get at the odd heterogeneity. And then the seismogram can be written still in a very simple form, basically the same way as in a spherical Earth, except that now you have a frequency shift, which is this location parameter, and to first order just depends on the great circle average, and this distance shift, so it would be the same functional dependence of the amplitude, but now you have to shift the distance by a small amount, which depends on the difference between the great circle and the minor arc average. And this is the expression that was used, was introduced first by Woodhouse and Jyromski in their first tomographic analysis in 1984, realizing that you needed a distance shift of some kind, depending on the odd structure, in order to correctly reproduce realistic seismograms. So you can write this more generally. This is for an isotropic source, and more generally, if A0 is the amplitude of mode K in the spherically symmetric model, you can write this amplitude term by just shifting the distance. Okay, and then I'll spare you all the rest of the details, but just walk you through rapidly. So we just saw that if you include a long branch coupling to the Earth's order, you are able to introduce this odd heterogeneity, and basically what you obtain in that case is the surface wave is a mode formalism that is equivalent to the standard surface wave approximation, and it's really what is referred to as the pass average approximation. Now, if you want to start modeling other complexities, and in particular body waves, you actually need to introduce a cross-branch coupling. And if you do this to zeroth order, you start seeing the ray character of the waves. I'll illustrate that in a moment. You obtain 2D kernels, which is kernels that are still located in the vertical plane containing the source and the receiver. And you can start modeling body waves in a more accurate manner than using ray theory, and relates that to waveforms without having to separate phases. And then if you add higher orders in the expression of the spherical harmonics, then you can start bringing out the out-of-plane effect. So the we've added the in-plane more accurate sensitivities. If you want to get the out-of-plane, the focusing and defocusing, you need to go to higher order in the expansion of the spherical harmonics. And you can show that these terms actually depend on the transverse derivatives along the great circle paths of these great circle and minor arc averages. So basically what it's saying is that the as the wave propagates, they get focused and defocused according to how fast the structure varies perpendicular to the great circle. If your structure is such that you don't have it varies sort of in ways parallel to the great circle, you will not have much of an effect. But on the other hand, if it varies rapidly across the great perpendicular to the great circle, you will have strong effects. Okay, so much for this. So let's get back to seeing in practice how this works. So again, to summarize, basically you have a progression. You go from 1D kernels, including the long branch coupling, the zeroth order asymptotics, to 2D kernels where you add the across branch coupling. And then if you want to have the out of plane, you need to go to slightly more complex expressions. And then, of course, you can ask, you know, why this gives you sort of a physical intuition on how things work. But you can, of course, compute the full first order perturbation approximation, which is just solving for the exact first order perturbation without doing any of these asymptotic approximations. This approximation is still, that's where you can get to the real 3D kernels. This is called 2.5 because you're really collapsing everything onto the great circle and only considering the variation of the great circle by the gradients or the curvature actually of your structure of the plane. And this is still a single scattering. And we'll be comparing this to the more exact, we'll be using as reference quote-unquote exact numerical computations that is afforded by this currently by spectral element method. And we'll be comparing some differences between synthetics computed in the PREM model and in simple 3D models. So kind of models we'll be comparing will be, for example, two anomalies of exactly the same size but opposite sign, and how they are they affect the waves according to different approximations. And then we'll also look at the specific case where you have only one anomaly. So this is a plane view, and then that has some depth dependence. So this is still very smooth anomalies. This is an anomaly which has wavelengths up to only degree 16 in a spherical harmonic expansion. We can look at what happens when you put it at different depths, but I'll only show a couple of these. So again, first we'll look at, you know, the next approximation after the pass average approximation, which is valid for surface waves, where you'd like to see, be able to use for waveforms of body waves, and therefore have the ray character of the waves. And this 2D kernels allow you to do this, and you can see this is a sensitivity kernel for this 2D approximation, which we call the nonlinear asymptotic coupling theory, you can, for an SS wave, you can start seeing this dependence on the ray path and with some widths and some amplitude variations also along the ray, which you don't get from ray theory. You can model as diffracted here also with sensitivity concentrated at the co-mantle boundary. And so, for example, in this example, you have a source on the left here, and the receiver is right in the middle between the two anomalies, the positive and the negative anomaly. What we're showing here is these are the numerical computations. So in black is the 1D reference model, so without the anomalies, and then the 3D computations, including the anomalies. The differences are not very large. You can barely see them. There's some difference in phase here at this scale. And what we're seeing here, these are waveforms that have been filtered at relatively long periods, about 100 second corner frequency. You can see the Rayleigh wave arriving here, and in front of it, one of these X phases, which is a combination of higher modes. But because the differences are not very large, actually what we're going to be looking at is the differences between the 3D and the 1D. And the difference between the 3D and the 1D in the spectral element method, so the numerical reference, will be in red, and then the different approximate computations will be in black. And you can see that for this particular geometry, what the waves are sensing, they're going right through one of the anomalies, and so the pass average approximation, the surface wave approximation, is pretty good. There's some here problems in the middle because, in fact, that anomaly isn't completely symmetric, but this is already a pretty good approximation. NACT does a little better, but it doesn't really make any difference. But if you put the receiver now on the other side of the second anomaly, what you see is that the pass average will average these two anomalies, so basically doesn't see anything. And so it will give you a flat line compared to what you would expect from the exact computation. And there, including this coupling across branch modes, which reveals the ray character of the body waves that that basically interfere to create this X phase, is important. And you can reproduce the waveform pretty well with this 2D approximation. And in fact, you can show that if the goal is still that we want to invert whole seismograms for structure without picking phases, and if you were to do this using the pass average approximation, you would see that you would lose resolution in the deep mantle, whereas if you do have the 2D broadband kernels, you can your resolution is still pretty good at the down to the base of the mantle. This is another example now in vertical cross sections where you basically compare, put in a synthetic model, invert using NACT, and you can recover this anomaly. This is love waves, including some higher mode data. But if you do the pass average, you recover it relatively well, but you lose amplitude and you have some jiggles in the shape. So for first and second generation tomographic models, maybe this is not a big issue, but as we want to get more and more into the details of the structures, getting to sort of shorter and shorter wavelength, this type of differences may start being important. And I will claim that perhaps some of the differences between the shapes of these superplumes, as seen in the different tomographic models, actually can be attributed to the different, not only to the different data sets used, but also to the different theoretical assumptions. Okay, let's move on. Now look at the effect of focusing. So now we've got a source, and then the path is outside of the anomalies. So the pass average approximation or the ray theory will not see anything because there's nothing along in the slice along the great circle, but in fact, because of this, because the waves sense not only the great circle but also structure around it, they will in reality be affected, and which you can see here with in the red curve, which is the difference between the SEM 3D and the SEM 1D. Mass average approximation gives you a flat line, doesn't see anything because it's completely outside. NACT doesn't help much, this 2D kernels, because the kernels are still in the 2D plane, and you really have to start including these off-plane effects to start being able to reproduce the actual amplitudes here, both in the fundamental mode and in the higher modes. You're not quite there yet with the asymptotic. Yes?
I think it's worthwhile pointing out that we can be both exactly that third part there, right? I mean, the differences between the 1D and the 3D things that contribute to this system. In practice, you would fit the record that well, you would say you've done a really good job.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to get a feeling for, you know, what.
But my point is that you won't do that because, as much as because of the source, as well as because of the radical, the level of radical detail that goes into it.
Yeah.
Some other issues.
Well, sure, yes. I mean, I'm just talking about the structure effects, you know, the wave propagation itself. Obviously, yes, the one thing is that as you start including effects off-plane, you also have to worry about the exact radiation pattern of the source, because you start including directions that are not right along the Great Circle Path, and therefore, if you don't have the... you can include some pretty nodal directions, and so if you don't have a very good, very well constrained source, you may introduce errors as well. Yes, certainly. Okay, this is another example showing the same thing. And again, here on the left, I show an example where you're going through the anomaly, although you're at the border, and then you're right outside of the anomaly. When you're going through the anomaly, in fact, pass average and NACT or NACT plus focusing give you a pretty good fit, whereas when you are outside, just outside of the anomaly, there is a difference in azimuth here is only 4 degrees, you really need the off-plane effects to exactly model the seismogram. So, and this one is the same, but adding the complete Born approximation, showing that in this particular case, or in some geometries, in fact, the asymptotic approximation can be works quite well. You don't have to go to the extra effort of computing exact Born kernels. So. Now some observations, you know, why would we want to worry about these effects of focusing or defocusing? Some of these effects are pretty strong in the data. For example, there are here three examples. The top traces are the observed seismograms. These are just low-pass filtered between 80 and 300 seconds. You see these R2 and R3 trains. So R2 is the train that arrives, the next train after the first arriving train, which has gone along the long pass between the source and the station. And R3 is like the first train, but it has gone around the Earth one more time. And the what you would expect in a spherically symmetric Earth is that the waves would be attenuated as a function of time. There's two effects that come into play. The so-called geometrical spreading, which is just the fact that it's spread out from the source, and you're traveling just along a particular path, you're losing energy to the sides all the time. And then also the effect of intrinsic attenuation in the Earth, which will always attenuate the waves. But in many cases, you can actually observe that the R2 train is smaller than the R3 train, which is something that is clearly a diagnostic effect of focusing or defocusing by lateral heterogeneity. And so this type of observation, the main reason for worrying about it at the present time is when you want to look at the anelastic structure of the Earth, which is for which you need to measure amplitudes. And therefore, the amplitudes are affected very strongly, not only by the cue, by the anelastic structure, which is what you want to infer, but also by these elastic effects due to focusing and defocusing along the path. And so, in order to really get at the attenuation structure, you would need to first model the elastic effect very accurately. But as I mentioned previously, these elastic focusing effects depend strongly on the gradients of structure. So you really need to very accurately know the elastic model before you can do accurate corrections to the amplitudes and retrieve accurate attenuation. In practice, so far, what's been done is that because we don't really know the elastic models well enough, what you do is you inspect the seismograms very carefully and you reject an enormous amount of data that show any sign of being strongly affected by focusing. So you end up basically at typical attenuation studies, you end up removing about 80% of your data set. So you can imagine that attenuation tomography is still lagging behind elastic tomography, because by rejecting so many of your data, you lose coverage, obviously, and so you can retrieve only the very long wavelength structure. Now this was just put in here to explain why it's still interesting to try and retrieve attenuation, and that's basically because the dependence of the elastic moduli and of attenuation with temperature are very different. Q is very strongly dependent on temperature. And so if you could both get the elastic structure and the anelastic structure, you would have complementary type information about the Earth's mantle, and maybe, and therefore be more in a position to really retrieve the physical properties of the mantle. So I wanted to just say a few words about attenuation tomography, because that's what I've been doing for 15 years. At the present time, as I said, it's very difficult because you need to, you know, do something about these off-plane effects. But I think it's fair to say that as of just now, I mean, just the last few years, the different groups that have been doing attenuation tomography have been converging, using very different approaches, getting models that look very compatible. So, for example, this is at 150 kilometers depth, or 160 kilometers depth, comparison of three models that have been obtained in very different manners. This is attenuation, so what is in red will now be high attenuation, and what is blue is low attenuation. And the top one is a model that we obtained using waveform inversion. This one is a model obtained using Rayleigh waves, amplitude of Rayleigh waves. And this is an even more different model, which is obtained using amplitude ratios of body waves, P and PP phases. And you can see that at this depth, the attenuation structure reveals the pretty much the tectonics. You see high attenuation following the ridge system in all these models, and then low attenuation corresponding to the old shields. So this is sort of getting stable at this point, at least at this type of scale of resolution, which is still pretty long wavelengths. It's about degree 8 equivalent. When you go deeper, then, I mean, we have a model which shows that the structure in the transition zone is somewhat different, but intriguing that it's basically made up of two very high attenuation regions under the superplumes in the Pacific and under Africa. It shows a good correlation with the hotspot distribution, especially if you take into account the buoyancy flux, whether or not it's calculated right or not by Davis and Sleep. And the question you might ask, you know, is how is this going to change when, you know, when you have a better way of accounting for the elastic structure? So we did an experiment where we compared what we could do without taking into account any of these focusing effects, basically just with rigorous data selection. This is in two depths in the transition zone. And then including accounting for focusing in an existing elastic model of the Earth, and then solving for the attenuation structure. When we include this, we allowed ourselves to go to a slightly higher degree of inversion, and then here even higher. And this comparison shows that, you know, the details change, but the large scale features seem to be pretty stable. So I would say that at this point, you know, we of course need to keep making more and more accurate corrections, but we're starting to have pretty stable models at the very long wavelengths for Q. So finally, I'd like to say a few words about modeling short-scale heterogeneity. Everything that I've said so far really applies still to relatively smooth models. The assumptions underlying the approximations still require that the wavelengths of the waves be short with respect to the wavelengths of the heterogeneity, although it actually works much better than the theoretical limits that you could impose. But if you want to model short-scale heterogeneity, you need other approaches, and I think that already at present the approaches that need to be applied are based on numerical modeling. There's been some recent observations of very strong heterogeneity at the base of the mantle. This is a study by Helmberger's group, which in one of their numerous recent studies of the African plume, showing some very sharp, that there must be some very sharp transitions at the base of the mantle at the borders of the African superplume. And you can see this in the data by looking at, this is a record section as a function of epicentral distance from an event here in the East Pacific Rise, observed an array in South Africa. And you can see that you have an abrupt shift of more than 5 seconds in time for the, I guess it's S diffracted, it's S and S diffracted phase, where this transition occurs over less than 1 degree in epicentral distance. So trying to model this kind of sharp transitions requires approaches that can handle strong small-scale heterogeneity. This is, and so I just wanted to show what Akiko To has been doing here. She's working on this type of problem where she's been looking at S-diffracted waves going here on sampling this part of the border of the African superplume and also some of the border of the Pacific superplume. There's some evidence from tomographic model. This is one of the tomographic models is plotted beneath. You have some transition from fast to slow velocities at the border of the plume, and she's observed some very strong variations too, where, I mean, very similar to what Helmberger has been saying, and both in the under the African plume and under the Pacific plume, where you would see here. She's looking now, instead of as a function of distance, she's looking as a function of azimuth. And again, she sees this phase shift from here. The blue line is a time shift, again, very large, on the order of 5 to 10 seconds. And then there is some very interesting complexity in the waveforms following this shifted arrival. She's tried to isolate or to sort of bring out some of the further arrivals. And these are just three different frequency, filtering frequency bands. This is, I think, 2 seconds corner, 5 seconds corner, and 18 seconds corner. If you look at the shorter periods, you start seeing some really interesting structure there, which she's been trying to model using a version of the spectral element model, which allows you to couple a numerical model in the region of interest here, d double prime, with a mode solution in the rest of the mantle. So basically, you assume that the rest of the mantle is spherically symmetric, and you concentrate on the effects of heterogeneity within the zone. The reason for doing that is that the mode part of the computation is very fast, and you just have a coupling interface here between the modes and the numerical solution. It's, of course, limited in application, because although you can work with S-diffracted waves, you couldn't model the little s-diffracted, which is very strongly affected by the upper mantle structure. But still, it's a start that you can actually do on a small cluster, computer cluster. And so these are some synthetics that she's been doing in a model where she has sharp transitions from slow to fast or from fast to slow, where she can reproduce some of these observations of not only the time shift, but also some later arriving phases that can be interpreted by reflections of some very sharp boundaries. So this is both an indication that there are very sharp boundaries down there, not only vertical perhaps, but also horizontal, as you might think about it more in a standard way, but also more vertically aligned. So this, I wanted to stop here to just inspire the mineral physicists about these kind of observations. Okay, that's it. Well, you can add several sandwiches. I mean, typically.
How hard is that? Is that like a completely new code, or is that just?
Each time, well, yes. I mean, Yann Capdeville, who did this, did spend a couple of months, coding up, going from just one interface, say, which he had started with, just to have two, so you can have a sandwich, and therefore, you know, the next step it would be maybe adding the upper mantle, and I'm not sure at what whether that's really worth it. You know, given that the numerical, powers of computers are increasing, I think.
But I guess the advantage is you could run these on smaller.
Yes. Well, that's right. That's
much higher spatial resolution.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
Higher frequencies.
Yeah, that's exactly what Akiko is trying to do. Yeah. And again, as I say, in a couple of years, this is not going to be an issue anymore. Well, this is, you can think of it as basically triplications coming, instead of usually when you think about triplication, you think about a layered structure in this direction, but coming from a boundary that's more vertical. But in order to generate these, you really need to have a sharp boundary, basically, so.
How plausible would it be to get a network of OBSs? Maybe something like the US array.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, that. Actually, that was my last slide, was to actually, yes, thanks for reminding me. In fact, there's been an effort that's been going on now for almost 20 years to try to expand the global seismic network to the ocean floor and to cover areas that have nothing, you know, within, say, 2,000 kilometers radius. And it's going very slowly. Initially, there were a lot of technical issues. You know, how do you bring power? How do you retrieve the data? how do you install seismometers on the ocean floor so that they produce decent data. A lot of these have been resolved now, and it's now a question of funding, because whereas a very high-quality land-based station may cost on the order of, say, if you include everything, may cost on the order of $100,000, say, a global type station. If you, portable stations are not as expensive, but a global seismic network station, it's an order of magnitude. It's big, you know, $2 million would be a cost of an ocean bottom station. So in recent years, there's been a trend, effort to combine the interest of the seismological or solid earth geophysics community, led by the seismologists, I must say, the seismologists have been the most active, with other communities, specifically the physical oceanographers, who are coming at it from a very different point of view. They, until recently, they like to just throw in probes into the oceans and let them drift, right, and then measure the currents. But they're now realizing that there is value in having time series at fixed points in the ocean as well. So there is currently an effort called, in the US, called the Ocean Observatory Initiative, which is submitted a proposal. Well, there is a proposal in the works in the major research equipment program at NSF to, you know, for ocean bottom stations. There's several aspects of this. So there's some arrays and there's some coastal observatories, but one of them is putting moored buoys in the middle of the ocean to complement the global network. Yes.
I'm just curious, in combining different types of data sets, like have you done things where you combine the body wave arrival times with waveforms?
Well, you don't. Okay, so what people have been doing, for example, the Harvard group is using waveforms for the surface waves and higher modes, and we can argue, I would argue with Adam, that the higher modes, you know, the path average approximation isn't really that good for the higher modes, but they do combine waveforms for the upper mantle and then travel times of body waves to get the lower mantle structure. And when you combine those, I think Adam actually showed a slide showing, you know, how you can get the resolution in the mantle. You get, you know, to first order, you get a pretty good you don't really need to go to a higher order kind of theoretical. We've been doing waveform inversions, just waveforms taking into account the, you know, the broadband kernels, and our models look to first order very similar to the models that other people have been using, have obtained using the standard theories. I think when we actually have a really exact, we are able to do an experiment with exact forward propagation using, say, the numerical SEM, and then inversion using the different approximations, that's where we're going to see, you know, which whether it is important or not. It's just very, I claim that I get more resolution by being able to include waveforms of other phases that, you know, phases that overlap, diffracted phases, etc.
You mentioned that to compute the inversion, you need to compute the cycle of emission and then give the time scale of that, how many minutes or how many hours you need to compute the
Okay, so with the asymptotic approximations, including the focusing, you can do a tomographic inversion using that as a forward modeling tool. You can now do a tomographic inversion using, I don't know how many, but hundreds of earthquakes. You can do this within 4 or 5 days. We have a cluster of 32 CPU cluster, and you can do it in less than a week. If you wanted to do the full numerical computation, even at the same scale, I think Jan computed that, and, you know, it was several years on the same computer still. Yeah. So that's why I think approximations are useful. Okay, well, can have a break.
It may be out there.
Out there, yes. We're having coffee out in the patio. We should.